Well, welcome to one of my favorite humans on the planet, Paul Stamets. That is great. So in the news today, you know, there's the concern about the young women kidnapped in Nigeria. And one of the people who was the ambassador to Nigeria said, Boko Haram should not underestimate the power of angry mothers. So I thought, that's a good meme, too. You know, our mother the Earth, we should not underestimate the power of angry mothers to protect life. So I was at your prodigious outpouring of knowledge last night, which was so powerful. Again, the mycelia, let me set us up a little bit for the mycelia. In mythology, when Hercules, Mars, was laying waste to the world, the gods gathered together and sentenced him to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving in order to repair the damage he'd done to the world. So I think this is perfect for you, Paul, because the mycelia are this underground, underworld weaving, right, to repair the damage of the world. So isn't it, I mean, all myths are really, you know, nature in cloaked form guiding us. So maybe, again, I know you've said this so many times, but for all of us, guide us into the mycelia, the underworld network, as a kind of positive Pluto underworld that is reweaving and knitting the world back into harmony in some form, yeah.
You are so eloquent. I come much more from a scientific perspective.
Excellent.
But this is why our coming together is a nice yin and yang. Well, the mycelium is a filamentous network that looks like cobwebs. And it's virtually under every footstep that you take. And most people don't realize that there's been a new super kingdom. Called Opisthokonta. Opisthokonta is a new super kingdom that joins animalia and fungi together. Now, what that means is that we have a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. And so we actually, our proto-ancestors were fungal. And the fungi chose the route of externally digesting its nutrients by producing little sweat droplets, little digestive enzymes, and breaks down plant and animal material, making soil. We each went the route of encirculating our nutrients, basically creating a stomach and digesting nutrients from within. So the mycelium went underground, and we kind of went overground, and we became animals, and fungi further developed. So these networks are vast, and they're membranes, and they're really based on the concept now that's a big buzzword in science called epigenesis. And their network-like design gives them the ability to adapt to catastrophia. And so if there's a sudden change in the ecosystem, whether it be tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, whether it be war, whether it be your footsteps breaking wood on the trail in the forest, the fungi leap up in your aftermath and gobbling up these nutrients. And it's the microdiversity, the biodiversity of fungi on the planet that really gives ecosystems the rich humus upon which we live. Now, everyone's heard how thin the skin of the earth is in terms of the soil, but it's a lot more fragile than people really understand. The bad news is that we're going into an extinction event. We're right in the middle of it. You may not see it day to day, but in the context of geologic time, this is happening in a flash. And we have about 8.3 million species on the planet. We're losing, by best estimates, around 30,000 species per year, which means in 100 years, we'll lose more than a third of the biodiversity on the planet that gave rise to us. So we live in the best of times. But I'm chagrined to say we might live in the best of the last of times. And we really need to wake up and start investing into the soil banks. You know, we have this crazy upside-down system where money is being chased in the milliseconds. And yet the very foundation of our food webs is unraveling beneath our feet. And at the current rate of loss of species on the planet, coinciding with increases in carbon dioxide. In 1955, when I was born, I'm 58 years of age, carbon dioxide levels were 315 parts per million. Now, just this past week, they raised to 401. That's a 27% increase in carbon dioxide in 58 years, the highest carbon dioxide levels in 10 million years. And this is not an arithmetically straight line. This is something that's curving up. And plus, there was a delayed action effect. So what we're measuring now, and some people said if we stopped all the CO2 pollution right now, it would still go up. Well, that should not give us solace or an excuse to not try. And what this means is that 401 parts per million, when it goes to 1,000 parts per million, and I know CO2 only too well because we grow massive amounts of fungi in our laboratory, they exhale carbon dioxide, they inhale oxygen. That's why we're so closely related to them. And so when CO2 levels go to 1,000 to 2,000 parts per million, exercise duration will be limited, asthmatics will be more challenged. And then this ends up reverberating throughout the ecosystem, and we face an extinction event. Now, scientists and politicians don't want to talk about this. Some politicians...
Well, it's changing.
It's changing. I would hope it's changing.
Inch by inch.
I mean, job security. This is what I hear. Job security. We can't afford to make an investment in the environment to offset global warming and CO2 because of jobs. Well, folks, there's no people. There's no jobs. And as the stress factors increase, as we decline through this extinction event, we're going to be facing challenges heretofore that are nightmarish in our imaginations. Now, counterintuitively, the fungi can do a lot to offset global warming. They actually sequester carbon dioxide. They're carbohydrate rich. They're polysaccharide rich, so there's lots of carbon there. They form these wonderful calcium oxalate crystals, which are two carbon dioxide molecules joined together. And so as the mycelium runs through the environment, it keeps carbon in the soil. And the carbon bank of the soil is being depleted. We have 10 to 15% of the wood debris naturally in the forest. Well, where did it go? Well, we vaporize it into the atmosphere. The more we can reinvest into the fungal networks and the matrix of cells in the soil that make up the soil, the more carbon can be sequestered. The humus layers are richer. They have more carrying capacity, more biodiversity, and we have a better chance of being able to grow food and preserve this wonderful planet that we know today.
And one of the great points you've been making your whole dedicated life, but also last night, is about partnering, that these are natural allies. And you gave us the great history that whatever life forms partnered with fungi had a better chance of surviving catastrophe, which means against the stars. Mm-hmm. Catastrophe. We don't need to know the star language, but it just says, our intuition knows the choreography. And when we go against, when we pit our small wills against the larger kind of will of nature, that is a catastrophe. So, partnering, because in public discourse, there's a really interesting novel by Elizabeth Gilbert called The Signature of All Things, in which the heroine is a botanist, which is remarkable and interesting, and 19th century. But it brings into the popular discourse, the work of Darwin, which was quite elegant. But what she points out is what Darwin was puzzled over and what he left out, and is altruism. It doesn't fit in that kind of... and then we get to the fungal realms, and in our discourse, you are a scientist, but you are also the perfect thing. You're an animist. You know that everything's alive, and the things I remember, and treasure from our conversing, years ago when I asked you about, can fungi or mushrooms metabolize radioactivity, and you said, no, nothing in nature can do that, but the little guys are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this idea of a partnering call and response that nature's right now, like, let's either kill the humans or heal them. We'll try healing them first on some botanists say it that way. I like that. So altruism, partnership. Can we speak to altruism and partnership? Because you spoke so fabulously last night about, the mycelia will transmit nutrients so that trees without light can derive nutrient. We'd say in a sense that's a mutual aid, symbiosis, partnership of altruism, right, in some way?
Mm-hmm. Well, the experiments that were done in the 1990s when they radioactively tagged carbon and nitrogen, it was a big mystery why hemlock trees growing on nurse logs in the old-growth forest could survive because there wasn't enough light for them to photosynthesize. And when they did the experiments, they found that alder trees that are living in more well-lit areas and along the rivers. It would translate, locate nutrients hundreds of feet and feed conifer trees, hemlock trees. And they thought that these were disparate ecosystems that were not connected. Well, in fact, the mycelium had a mothering influence trying to guarantee the biodiversity of the ecosystem, because from that biodiversity of the ecosystem gave the ecosystem the ability to support myriad numbers of different organisms that are collaborating with one another. You know, some people may have heard about this. We are more bacteria than we are actually human cells.
We're a huge community.
We're huge communities. We have more than 100 trillion bacterial cells to the 10 trillion human cells. Now, they're smaller, and so the mass is about the size of a grapefruit in terms of all the bacteria if you collected it all together. You know, we tend to be more massive in our cellular structure. But the fact is that we are these giant communities, and recently, the Center for Disease Control reached out to us, and it's a real interesting paradigm shift in the understanding by physicians. The antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria in hospitals are a huge threat to our biosecurity and our health. And the overuse of antibiotics is having a devastating effect on our microbiome. It's disrupting lots of those natural bacteria that are present that makes us us. And so we need to overuse its antibiotics. It's a selection criteria that ends up evolving antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria that then take front stage and imbalance the microflora that makes us healthy. And then these organisms then emanate outwards, and the overuse of antibiotics is now causing antibiotics to be less effective. There's no really good new antibiotics on the horizon. And so some of the most advanced thinking microbiologists and researchers that I'm in contact with, including at the CDC and NIH, is maybe we should go back to looking at the complexity of nature, because the complexity of nature gives us an armamentarium of defenses that a single agent antibiotic does not afford. And, you know, who knew that foods are medicine? This is like, oh,
well,
what?
Our ancestors apparently. Yeah, yeah. Right.
And so 70% of all anti-cancer drugs are derived from nature. This is something the pharmaceutical industry does not like to boast about. But indeed, you know, most of our medicines are nature-born, and they've been proven through the theater of evolution, foods have been, to be safe. So many of the mushroom species that we grow have thousands of years of history of use. And to put this in the context, about 70% of the microorganisms in soil are fungi. About 40% of the organic mass in soil are fungally derived, living in dead organic mass. And so these rich soils can have literally hundreds of millions of living little microbes per gram. Now, that's a symptomatic of typically healthy soils, is tremendous diversity and tremendous numbers, and they're fungally dominant. And the fungi preselect out bacterial communities that are commensal, that can help give rise to the plants that grow up, that create the debris fields that feed the forest. When we start robbing the carbon bank, we're disrupting that microflora. Then we've been mentioning antibiotics in hospitals, but we can talk about pollutants having a destructive influence on the microbial universe of the soils. And so we're getting really imbalanced. And there is sort of a bladder effect. It takes a while for the ramifications of this can be seen. But now it's being seen now because of the Industrial Revolution. We're now seeing these ecosystems just sort of delaminate, begin to fall apart. And the thinning of the soils now, is the thinning of the humus layers, is causing premature decline of forests because of over-harvesting of trees and logs and monoculture. And then when you cut down a diverse forest and you grow up a single-age trees, you've lost the ability of those trees to respond to varying conditions because now they're all the same age group. The soil's thin, and we get what's called premature decline. The trees start falling over. And so the Weyerhaeuser has reframed its philosophy of his company.
Uh-huh.
It's no longer a lumber company.
Huh?
It's a land holding company.
Really? Yeah. Are they doing mycelia protection, honoring?
I wish they would be.
Oh,
but,
well, let's open that door.
Well, I mean, after three or four cuts, you know, on of a forest within 100 years, the humus layer thins so much that the root wads can't hold the trees up. And so you have premature decline, the trees start falling over, diseases spread. And then they come in and say, oh, we should burn. You know, so it's like a doubling down. Now, all the carbon goes into the atmosphere in one day. And if you kept the carbon in the soil and you build up the carbon bank, the best reserve of carbon on the planet above ground are old growth forests.
Right.
And we need to protect the forest ecosystems. And the example of Easter Island is a classic one. Most researchers believe deforestation led to the demise of the people on Easter Island because of deforestation. And the wealth of our environment is our heritage that we've received from our ancestors, which we need to pass on to our descendants. And if we rob the carbon bank, we're robbing the wealth of our future descendants.
And one of the brilliant things you did last night and forevermore spiraling is you showed, even on crude economic terms, you know, that maintaining the ecosystem would lead to more timber possible, even in crude economic terms. And this is, you know, so last night, you know, you're doing a great thing, as we aspire to do, crossing borders. You know, crossing borders out of the like-minded ghetto into realms of influence. And so we don't need to mention who was there last night, but there were some grown-ups, right?
Yeah, there were some grown-ups.
There were some grown-ups, okay, let's just say that. And what I do when I cross borders, like I went to the Conservative Political Action Committee, you know, I go to the underworld, that form of underworld, to see if there's anybody there, you know, and there are. You know, there's no place so dunderheaded that there are not allies. And I like that. This guy who was magnetized, you know, and was like, oh, talking about wolves and mushrooms, you know, I'm hungry for this conversation. Come be my date at the Reagan banquet. I was like, okay. Turns out he was head of his, when he sent me the photo of us, his tagline was CEO Petroleum Inc. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I sent him Amory Levin's kind of energy plan, and I'd sort of turned him into a, you know, Republican platinum card cartoon. But he sent back a reflective email, and he goes, I was working with Amory in the 70s on early solar panels, but I don't trust Amory's economic numbers. So I come back to our team and the likes of yourself going, the Dementors, the fossil fuel industry, they want numbers. They want to see how the economy can work. And so it behooves us to broaden the vision, going, if we look longer than 2 inches, then here's reciprocal blessing.
Biodiversity is biosecurity. And that's the important thing. So once we lose our biodiversity of our habitats, we lose clean water, we lose our food networks, then we have increased stress socially, end up to political dissent, you know, struggling for resources, competition, goes to poverty, leads to terrorism. So some advanced thinkers at the Department of Defense, which I have to say, there are some good people there.
That's right. You know, we say to our team, you know, easy, willingness to cooperate with everybody.
It's a diverse population. There's definitely some Darth Vaders in that group as well.
Yeah.
But they really focus on that the health of the ecosystem leads to more political stability and wealth and affluence. When you feed people, you don't have disease, you don't have stress, you know, and or less stress. And so this is really important. But to kind of bring in the context for the listeners here, we have this piece of land in Canada. It's 160 acres. And for 3 years, I was a logger. I suffered.
This is important.
I was a young man.
It's like Milarepa was a murderer before he became the greatest saint. And not you. You're not a murderer. But turning around.
Well, I was in the woods, and I set chokers, and I could see where all the carbon was going, but where did it come from? And it took 10,000 years to create these forests, and then in the 1900s, Europeans came, they cut down the old-growth forests, and they burned two withdrawals from the carbon bank that took 10,000 years to produce. And 1950, second-growth forest, what do? Cut them down again, burn, four withdrawals. The year 2000, or present day, third-growth forest, what do? Cut them down, burn them again, six withdrawals from the carbon bank, you know, in 100 years, it took 10,000 years to produce. And so with this land up there, we planted 35,000 trees, and we put 1,100 trees in an Excel spreadsheet that we tagged. And we used trees with and without mycorrhizae and trees with collars of wood chips around the tree, each tree, as opposed to no wood chips, to see if you keep the carbon on the soil, will the trees grow faster. We looked throughout the forestry journals. We couldn't find a single experiment on this level showing, well, because it takes some patience. And the short-term return on the investment, let's cut the forest. And the economic metric they're using is timber board feet of lumber. They're not valuing clean water, biodiversity, recreation, you know, for your children walking through the woods, all the secondary forest products that are sustainable coming out of the forest over a long time. And so I realized, well, they're not going to buy into this more superb and more eloquent ecological metric, but if you're going to meet them on their playing field, which I don't agree by their rules, but we must play it by that in this capitalistic system, can we increase timber board feet of lumber in a forest by not burning and by using mycorrhizal fungi? And we've been charting this now for 9 years. We have now a clear separation of data, statistically significant, showing the trees are growing faster and they're growing taller, the girth is wider, and so we are actually getting a return on our investment. And if we can show this is a better way, then we can create a multi-generational paying it forward. So people in the future can go back and go, well, there was a better return on investment by preserving the ecosystem rather than slashing and burning. Now, burning is a very controversial subject, and there are reasons for burning, but I think in the context of the larger view, keeping the carbon on the ground rather than jettisoning it in the atmosphere is much better.
Because you mentioned last night also an ongoing that if you can, because we have drought, you know, everywhere and the burning and the. But you mentioned that if one can keep the wood chips on the ground for 3 years, if you can make it to three mm-hmm. years, then the mushrooms and mycelia will actually produce water.
The mushrooms actually produce water as they break down wood chips.
Right.
They keep the water in the matrix of the cells. So these spongy environments that you walk through the woods and you can feel, you know, those myceliated environments are water retentive. With the big landslide outside Oso, Washington, that's where I lived.
Right.
I live 5 miles from there.
Really?
I know Gary Jones. I used to work for him.
Wait, who is he?
Well, he's the timber owner, timber company owner, that petitioned to have that area logged. And one of the letters are going back and forth from one of his employees against one of the regulators is saying, oh, you're just opposed to logging. You're just an environmentalist. And they finally caved in from the criticism, and so they allowed this to be logged again. It was not an old-growth forest. It had been repetitively logged. And because the root structure in the mycelium was not placed,
right.
It led to the erosion and the slippage of this mud that killed all these people.
And it is.
And you can bet that every one of those families is much more pro-environmental now, subsequent to the fact, than they were prior, because they have a real-time experience of losing their loved ones and seeing what happens when you cut down the forest on steep slopes and you get the soil cannot retain its structure and it's lost and it sloughs off.
There was conniption fit inducing, you know, oblivion even afterwards, going, well, there's no actual direct evidence that clear cutting contributed to, you know, anyway. So there is that. But as you're saying, people who are experiencing real suffering go, it's common sense.
Well, I think there's a lot more environmentalists in Texas now because of the drought. I mean, it's always
the time of unusual alliances, the Indian Cowboy Alliance, you know, about the XL pipeline and the Texas claiming of land. There are great opportunities for unusual alliances, you know, humans to mycelia, Indians to cowboys.
We really need the fact that we focused and we created these economic metrics solely based on money. And divorcing ourselves from the value of what the ecosystem contributes, I think is really, we need to have a paradigm shift in our consciousness and start creating a new value.
Wealth.
And carbon is wealth,
yeah.
You know, in all of its forms. And when we put it into the atmosphere, you know, this is a real serious moment. People do not understand how serious it really is. But some of the best thinkers in the world now charting this out into the future, and I challenge anybody here, you know, look at all the data and go out 500 years. You might say, well, I don't care. It's beyond my lifetime. Really? Will you think the same way 500 years earlier? Your ancestors had that point of view, and you inherited the environment that we're going to give 500 years from now to our descendants? You know, this is really important. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment. And this is something that we need to be front and center. And I don't think people should be bashful. Environmentalists have been really weak in so many of their and they're being challenged by these sort of alpha personalities that use jobs and economics and their votes in the next election as being something that overwhelms their point of view.
Well, and again, I think part of your living treasure contribution to the team is for all of us to be all hands on deck, who brought what, to be engaging storytellers. And see, people do not react defensively when you go, "Did you know? Mm-hmm. Did you know this thing?" Mm-hmm. And rather than just tantrum yoga, going, "Oh, you're bad." You know, so for all of us, the more we know, and the more we study with you, you know, and other keepers of crucial nature based knowledge, you know, the more we can go, "Did you know about this?" Because people go, "I didn't know," or "I didn't know," unless we have a snarky attitude when we're asking. But I mean, did you know? And there is a shift, you know, that we're all a part of, you know, putting up our sails to catch this thing, you know. The Years of Living Dangerously, don't know if you've seen that on Showtime, really good.
No.
Oh, it's really good. It's really good. Again, you know, medium mainstream. And it's starting with kind of right-wing Christian, politically right fundamentalists, you know, the daughter slowly persuading her mega church, you know, guy. So we're going there. It's like, you know, E.O. Wilson, when he was working with, or is working with, you know, kind of evangelicals, said, "We, you know, I'm a Harvard scientist, they're evangelicals, we let's disagree far in the future. Right now we have a common purpose of saving the earth." And he said, the medicine we want from disparate people is it's going to take a religious fervor wedded to science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, these unusual kind of dynamics. But yeah, there's a great show called Your Inner Fish on PBS. You know, again, the water, land thing about how the entire history of life lives in us. Cosmos on Fox, mm-hmm. is Neil deGrasse Tyson is actually quite grounded. He's delineating stories of people who, you know, same reverent common sense, who came up against the oil industries and who, you know, slowly won. And he's sending out, going, "It's time, everybody, not unlike yourself." So there's a shift. We might go too late, but better late than never. I mean, this and I want to come back to, you know, this trickster ingenuity quality in nature, that the fungi love. They love crisis. They love catastrophe. Mm-hmm. They're our allies. Coyotes love unstable footing. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, so some of the cutting edge research that we've done, we received an EPA grant, phase one, on microfiltration for removing E. coli from point sources of pollution using wood chips and mycelium. And we used 12 different species, and we found one species in particular that had an enormous appetite and was able to reduce the E. coli populations about 20% per 2/3 of a cubic foot of wood chips. And so we have gray field installations now in several locations. We have an article being published in a peer-reviewed journal. We have a downloadable report on our EPA study. But we started doing something because I was always fascinated by this, is the mycelium pre-selects, because it produces antibiotics, but it pre-selects then bacteria. This is my hypothesis, that would be beneficial to the ecosystem that give rise to the trees that create the debris fields that feed the mycelium. I don't think things just rot indiscriminately. You know, they actually are there, and they set up the landscape and the microbial populations subsequently. And so what we did is it's called next-gen sequencing. It's advanced DNA testing. And we had two different species of mycelium growing on the same wood chips. And then we sequenced thousands of bacteria, and we found a 1,000-fold difference in the relative populations of the bacteria between two different groups of wood chips with two different sets of mycelium. They pre-selected groups of bacteria that were commensal bacteria beneficial to them. And now the test for us mycologists is, well, what does the mycelium look like? It's incredibly tenacious. And these wood chips, you physically have to rip them apart. It's super tightly weaved, luxuriously white, very, very scentful. And so it's very healthy mycelium, yet it's full of bacteria. But the different subsets of bacteria between these two different colonies of mycelium were incredibly different. And it, I think, is a first step in proving that these mycelial networks set the stage for the bacterial communities that lead preferentially to the plant species that will feed them into the future.
Which is mutual aid, symbiosis.
It is. It's mutualism. Yeah. I mean, right. Life is, you know, that Darwin was right about natural selection.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really hip on communities, you know.
No, but he knew that.
But he had a sense of that. But yeah. Now, you know, natural selection for the individual does not work without the support of all the other members in your community.
Libertarians take note. Yeah, exactly.
So it's really important that, you know, it's hard. Like, I saw Ziggy Marley on Bill Maher last night, which I just loved, you know. And he has a song which I have not heard, but I love the title, "I Don't Want to Live on Mars." And I thought, well, yeah, let's reinvest on the planet. And, you know, I go to these TED conferences, and we have all these fantastic little gadgets, you know. And I look at all this technology and Google Glass, and I love the people at Google. But, you know, I just have to say to them, you know, boy, we'll have all this great technology to measure the collapse of the ecosystem beneath our feet. Because before we go to the stars, and they have this moonshot project, which, great, you know, let's have a moonshot. I think we need to have an earth shot. I think we need to focus on the soil beneath our feet before we start thinking about escaping the planet. Because very few people are going to escape the planet.
No, and what I always say is, like, no, boys, you cannot leave the planet till you've cleaned your room. No, none of that. Yeah, but, you know, even going back into the 70s, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance said, you know, for everyone in our magic backpack of effectiveness, the difference between price and cost. And now we get into the realm of wealth. What is a wealthy community? What is a wealthy life? You know, it's not the same as money. It doesn't exclude money, but it's not the same. And their dynamic was, you know, the price of putting, you know, rock salt on the roads, cheap. The cost, enormous, in terms of destruction of, you know, infrastructure and pollution of water. And if we factored in the true cost to community, it opens up our imagination. Mm-hmm. They were doing cool things, like the city of Chicago was going to widen its commuting roads and stuff. And they came in and said, well, you know, here's the price, but here's the cost. And for a fraction of the cost, you can hardwire everybody's homes and they wouldn't have to commute and do that. So that got parked somewhere. But the city of Los Angeles agreed to give a cost to human suffering, you know, coughing episodes and emphysema and stuff. And when they factored that in as a cost, they go, we can't afford the internal combustion engine. You know, slow to respond, but still, cost versus price, I think, is something we all want to go, going, that's the price, sir. What's the cost? To tease it out into the entire thing.
Right.
And to hold corporations accountable for cost. Well, that's even sort of remedial.
But in terms of biodiversity, every species has a skill set. And we're just discovering what these skill sets are slowly as time goes on. There's a mushroom from the old growth forest that we've spent an enormous amount of energy on. This is the longest living mushroom in the world. It looks like a giant bee's nest. Yeah. It is called agaricon. Agaricon only grows in the old growth forests of Northern California, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, a few sky islands in Europe, and the Slovenian Alps. And there's one or two, it's a few places in Russia. And I was involved with the BioShield program of the U.S. Defense Department, which they screened 700 samples, and lo and behold, agaricon was highly active against flu viruses, including bird flu. I just received a patent on this. It took almost 8 years. The DOD, Department of Defense, sequestered it because of biosecurity. They finally released it and had a unanimity of opinion of 10 examiners to be approved. You know, it's been approved, and we are working towards going eventually to have animal and clinical studies. Well, very, very interestingly, 2 years ago, Vector, which is like Fort Detrick of Russia, published a paper, and they found also, in surveying all these fungi, that agaricon was the most active and extremely active against bird flu. No human toxicity whatsoever. Well, the good news is the Russians validated that which we discovered with the BioShield program, U.S. Defense Department, and I've been able to make the argument, received very, very well, that we should therefore save the old growth forests as a matter of national defense.
That always brings big applause.
Yeah, so, okay, but, yeah. But it's real.
It's real.
And the Russians have discovered this as well. And so really? If we have a bird flu pandemic, you know, finding new remedies to be able to mitigate the disaster that bird flu, which is not a possibility, it's a probability. There is a bird flu pandemic on the near event horizon. It is coming. We've had them before. There's too many factors now of commingling and too many epicenters that make the bird flu pandemic as a probability. But what are we going to do?
And well, that's why I always keep my Michael Shield handy.
Yeah, I can't talk about that. So
you can't?
No.
What do you mean?
Well, that's good. I'm glad you have your Michael Shield handy.
Well, it's a product we're offering on our fund drive, but I'll do that on my own.
Okay. Yeah. So, but this is an example of a species, you know, that has the ability And it's because of this pharmacology. These mushrooms have up to 200,000 compounds. They have about 16,000 genes. We have about 22 to 23,000 genes. And they're coding for hundreds of thousands of compounds. And so they're really like miniature pharmaceutical factories. But our ancestors over the millennia have gone into the landscapes and they've surveyed and tested about 14,000 species that are out there that we know about. And through the generations, we've selected out about 50 species that are premier species that are totally safe to consume, and which pharmacologically now are showing us benefits that can empower our immune system and increase our ability to stave off disease. So preserving our ecosystems preserves the medicinal libraries of nature that are so important for us, which we may not know how important they are now.
No,
but trust me, that right. biodiversity is something we want to have you know, at our fingertips to be able to tap into, because at the theater of evolution over hundreds of millions of years have been very smart choices on the evolutionary path, and we need to take advantage of this natural intelligence that we have resident in our ecosystems.
Right. Well, that's the long useful query. Will we find the thing that heals us before we kill it?
Yeah.
You know, that's a human thing. But two things on Agarikon. So I ran into some of the attendees at your splendid presentation last night afterwards. You know, and they were like, So Agarikon limited. How do we not, you know, wipe it out? Because you can grow it.
Yeah, I have. It takes literally about 1 out of 50 adventures in the old growth forest before we find them.
Yeah.
I started pursuing this in the 1980s. We have now 70 strains of Agarikon, the largest genomic library in the world. We submitted the sequences to GenBank, so we created the DNA sort of fingerprint for Agarikon so other researchers can go and see if they have it. And we take a small piece of tissue the size of your fingernail, so we leave the Agarikon in the ecosystem.
And that could be
And that could be grown, fortunately. It can be scaled up.
So what prevents the Dementors from going, well, Paul's already got samples, let's just kill everything else?
That's a really good question. Because with the BioShield Biodefense Program, we submitted, I think, 8 strains of Agarikon. 3 of them were active against viruses. 1 was a superstar.
Uh-huh.
And so if you lose that biodiversity, and it's like with penicillium molds, they found the same thing. Some penicillium molds were very active in the production of penicillin, some were not. So, you know, the strain diversity within a species is of paramount importance. Every apple or orchardist knows this. Every gardener knows this. You know, the same is true with as plants. It's true with fungi.
Wait, and say again. They know this. What?
Well, some strawberry strains are better than others.
Some corn strains are better than others.
You know.
So that's enough to prevent the Dementors from going, well, kill it all because Paul's got samples going. No, there's always more we need to know. We have to protect the source.
Yeah, the larger your library of knowledge, yes. I think the greater the knowledge base you have to tap into.
That's great. Yeah. So we like to say let all natural facts be social strategy metaphors. To protect wolves. Farley Mowat just died yesterday. Bless his heart. Let's become more like wolves to protect water. Let's become like water. How would we become more like mycelia? Well, you jump us to the internet.
Well, the organization of the Mycelial Networks has a self-sustaining design that allows it to survive the impacts from rapid changes. And epigenesis is the response of an organism to an environmental stimulus, and then genes that code a response that gives you a survival advantage, they're upregulated. So the advantage of the mycelial networks is at the very tips, they have more than one nucleus. Most mushroom mycelium, for instance, has 2 nuclei per cell, but at the tips, they have hundreds and hundreds of nuclei. And think of them as like little scientists, and there's hundreds of millions of branches in the swath of mycelium. If you spread your arms out and or laid on the ground, I mean, that would be hundreds of millions of end branchings. And at these tips, they're like reformulating constantly. They're testing if there's a new toxin, a new insect, a new piece of wood, some foreign material that's a potential food source. If they reassemble and produce a novel enzyme, then they're rewarded. The mycelium surges, it gobbles it up, and that information comes back channeled into the mother mycelium. So these are self-learning membranes.
So how do we become more like that?
Well, I think we are becoming more like that. Our internet-based society is a reflection, of, I think, of a previously proven evolutionary successful model.
And so
we are destined to repeat that in nature, which has been successful.
And you now, have great slides about how dark matter, again, mycelia net, it's all interwoven. We love symmetry.
Well, it's the archetype of the universe.
Right.
And I have I think it's, we won't know in our lifetimes, but I'll say this for the record for the future, but I think we'll find network-based organisms throughout the cosmos. Uh-huh. And they oftentimes will be mycelial-like in their structure. And so I think we have 20 billion now estimated Earth-like planets in the Milky Way.
Right.
20 billion.
Boys still can't leave the planet to clean their room. Right?
But I think, personally, I grew up in a highly religious evangelical environment. And I love my mother. She gives Christians a good name, right. I will say. Yeah. We have real different views on different subjects.
Also, you have your own E.O. Wilson evangelical homestead.
But they are very interested in food security.
Yeah.
They don't like the government on their backs.
Right.
They want to be independent. They want to be able to make their own choices. So they're freedom fighters in their own right, insofar as that goes. But the idea of being able to have your own medicines and have your own food is of paramount importance, and that's something that we all share.
And we can direct mistrust the pharmaceuticals, mistrust whatever. I mean, there are things to mistrust. What was the one cancer drug you were mentioning last night that that you said that use of some mushrooms clinically will enhance the efficacy of the good cancer drugs? And you said there was one.
My mother is a cancer survivor.
Right.
And she had advanced stage 4 breast cancer.
Right.
She had not seen a doctor since 1968. Her tumors made her right breast 5 times the size of her left. Metastasized across the meridian. She had angry lymph nodes all over her body. Cancer invaded her sternum and her liver. And she was put on a drug called Herceptin, which is okay. Wonderful. And then...
What is that derived from, or is it related to any botanical...
I have to go back into literature.
Okay.
It's from an herbaceous plant originally,
we'll
morph from there. And then she started taking turkey tail, which contains a protein-bound polysaccharide, which has been called PSK. And then they did studies showing that PSK and Herceptin together potentiated the activity of Herceptin. And so my mother is now, this next month, 5 years cancer-free. And she's...
And it's a great slide of her. She looks beautiful.
Yeah, she's been written up in several medical journals.
Yeah,
she is. She's... She's charming, and it's this wonderful story that, she is alive today because we were facing an extremely, she was going to die within a few weeks, few months.
And medical science had said, you're 83, and, wrap it up, you're lucky, goodbye, we have nothing for you. I think, Part of the art, or the medicine we're deriving from your work and all of our team, I love Lily Yeh, who makes art, and goes to broken places to work with broken things and do healing. But one of the great things at the Dandelion School in Beijing, which is the only school for the children of migrant workers, one of the young women said, since Lily guided me to my own creativity, I am no longer willing to accept the fate that was assigned me.
Hmm.
Right? And I think that that's also, like your mom. You go, that's what you say, medical orthodoxy, but I am no longer willing to accept the fate that was assigned
me. I think we can make our own future.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's not resign ourselves and be depressed about the collapsing ecosystems.
No, there's no future in nihilism.
Time for us to put these things into action.
So what do you think, I ponder this, what do you think is unique about our species? I'll just prime the pump by going, our rudeness is unique, but I think also that it might be, and this is what I want to toss to you in your scientist animism perfect blend, it might be that we as a species are capable of borrowing the quality of intelligence or the medicine from the flora and fauna on this planet, going, let us learn, let us, the quality, the medicine of ingenuity and mycelial networks, the medicine of wolf leadership, but I don't know if that resonates with you, but what do you think is unique to our species, aside from our horrific rudeness?
My goodness, what a very potent question that is.
Yeah, what is our ideal function in the ecosystem? What are we supposed to be doing?
Agents
of symbiosis.
Well, this is where what's the division between instinctive reaction versus intelligent reactions, and this is something that We can say that animals react instinctively, but we have this cognitive ability of being able to override our instinctive responses. So cognitively, we might be able to override instinctive reactions. That might be one element of that.
I mean, there, because there is that curious esoteric phrase that says nature unaided always fails, which gets our hackles up in a way. But what you're saying is, yeah, to override the purely reactive instinctive can be an evolutionary spiral.
Yeah, but, you know, the whole concept of biomimicry has has just really given us really practical breakthroughs from you know, being able to move water with Jay Harman's fantastic inventions.
Spirals,
you know, going to stealth bombers, you know, it's like, so...
Wait a minute, the stealth bombers are just flying in spirals?
No, but their form is such that they limit wind disturbance.
Yes,
so,
there is that.
Even watching how we had this amazing experience where an owl flew down our chimney and we were gone for a long time and my wife heard something in the fireplace and above the flue, which was closed, and we opened it, and this owl flew out of our chimney. And so with this owl flying around our house for about a half an hour, and it was crazy, and it was totally silent. I knew owls were silent in nature, but having it right 10 feet away from you...
Really, there was
flying,
enough glide? There was enough glide room in your house?
Yeah, when we crashed into the lamp and things like that.
But there was enough glide?
It was flapping its wings. It wasn't gliding. It was too small of a space. But the fact, I was like mesmerized. This thing is flying in pure silence. And then it took us a while to figure this out. And then we realized that we turned off all the lights and we opened up the door.
Yes.
And so it then navigated to the darkness.
Right.
And the darkness was the opening. I flew out. But my wife and I were just like, it was symbolically very cool.
Yeah.
It was really made us on edge because they didn't want this poor thing to get hurt.
No.
But to see it in action, it was so close. And to realize that the absence of artificial light led it to the path to escape.
Right.
And I thought a lot about that symbolically. Yeah. Oftentimes it's not going towards the light.
No,
but it's
the
absence of
the dark, my son.
Yeah,
great.
The absence of the artificial,
yeah.
You know, draws. You know, one of my things that I've realized, and I've failed a lot, but the cost of failure is the price of tuition I've learned, I've paid to learn a new lesson.
Email moniker, yeah.
Yeah, and that's something that's really important,
right.
Is that understanding that just by trying and trying frequently, often, and expecting failure and rejoicing in failure, that's okay.
Right.
You know, but those people who don't try and fail, you know, I don't want to call them lazy, but, you know, either you're in the lifeboat, paddling on the lifeboat, or you're not, you know, and I think that people need to try.
Well, it's also, you know, in the kind of mythological language, we go, in nature, trickster ingenuity Uranus, a trickster, represents nature's evolutionary ingenuity, which has no category about success-fail. It's try it. Let's put big ears on this mammal, see if it lasts for 5 million years. You know, I mean, nature's not worried about, will humans think this is silly if big ears are on this mammal? So to partner with nature, as you're doing, is to go, try this. You know, and even, you know, leading Nobel scientists to whom I'm related, the good part of partnering with them is they're in favor of broad-based research, because they say, I set out to learn about breast cancer, I learned nothing about breast cancer, but I learned a great deal about, you know, inadvertently about, you know, brain cancer, and my partner working on brain cancer learned nothing about brain cancer, but he learned a lot about, you know, breast cancer, which is why, you know, all of the most rational people are like, you know, more research, more knowledge, because you never know. You know, you want to be curious. We want to change our human interface to, you know, informed, reverent curiosity.
That's so true. I grew up in a small town in Ohio, but we had a fairly large house, and we had a fully equipped laboratory in the basement. Not little Paul, unfortunately.
Oh.
I had four older brothers.
Oh, for big,
and my
big guys.
Brother John went to Yale, my brother Bill went to Cornell, but they would never let me in the laboratory.
Really? Because I was quirky Bill?
No, you know
quirky
him.
Genius Bill.
Yeah,
I know him.
They wouldn't let me in the laboratory because I was the youngest brother, but then they all went off to college, and I was left with a a fully equipped laboratory. Yeah. So I've had all these experiments. The first ones I went to were danger, do not bring near flame, you know, big red boxes. So I practically blew up the house a few times. And
like you do.
Yeah. My mother came down and went, what was that? And I go, it's fine, don't worry.
Nobody's perfect.
But my dream was to live in the country and have my own laboratory.
Oh, you so did that, it. You
so
did
I did it.
Glenn.
So now I live in the country and I have these very large laboratories. And we produce more than 20,000 kilos of mycelium per week. Huh. This is in vitro grown mycelium.
And seeing you in your hairnet and in the lab in the vastness. I mean, you've really been manifesting.
Well, when you grow things that are bigger than yourself, number one, you instantly have an empirical respect for it because if it falls and it could hurt you or
you mean it's a bigger giant than agaricon could fall over you.
Well,
life,
when you're surrounded
by one framed in freak accident.
When you're surrounded by tons of mycelium, it works. It's an organism on a different level. That you would normally understand. And so you, when you walk into our laboratories, the scent signatures of the mycelium outgases, fragrances that attract insects.
Ah, yes.
And so the mycelium is constantly outgassing these fragrances to entice insects to come and engage them. And many spores of fungi are carried by insects because when the mushrooms come up, they only come up typically for a few days and they're gone. But that's the time of sporulation, so attracting insects to carry their spores is one of the things that we kind of sense. When you go into a forest after rain, it smells so rich, and that most of that's coming from the outgassing of mycelium that's in the ground.
Right.
It's metabolizing very quickly, so it's producing these extracellular metabolites that are scentful. But in our laboratory environment, when we have like 500 species in culture, but we'll walk into a room that has 25 species, you get mosaics.
Fragrant mosaics.
Overlapping fragrances.
Mm.
And that's incredibly reminiscent of going into a forest.
We love complexity.
Yeah, so the complexity of the scent trails coming from the mycelium in our laboratory mimics that of the scent trails that I experience in an old-growth forest. And so it's we like to deeply inhale, you know, as we go into the laboratories because the scent signatures tell us a lot about the quality of the mycelium.
So is it, whatever happened to the termite, you found the mushroom that was toxic to termites, but they loved eating it and was non-toxic to everything else. And I remember being at a number of meetings with termite industry guys, and they went to sleep. All right, is it sad?
Well, and I have 8 patents on this now, and better for me to have the patents than Monsanto for anybody who's critical. These are my inventions. I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, of my own research. The patents have been approved just recently for all insects and all entomopathogenic fungi.
So it's a non-toxic.
It's non-toxic
thing.
Every termite nest in the world has a fungus garden, graveyard. Where the fungi are being grown. Most insects are mycophagous. They eat mycelium. A lot of insects use fungal networks as part of their host defensive resistance. So the Lepiota mushroom is used by Atta species of ants, and they honeycomb the ant mounds with mycelium of this Lepiota mushroom because it selects a bacterium that produces an antibiotic active against a fungus that would kill the nest. The ants discovered this 25 million years ago,
so
they paired with fungi because the fungi produce an antibiotic that would select out a bacterium that would prevent another fungus from coming in.
Yeah.
This is like
partnering.
They discovered this 25 million years ago.
Really,
they
ants did?
The ants did.
25 million years.
And we discovered it 5 years ago.
Okay, so we're slow learners, but you know, and respect for ants.
But the other side of that is that there's a form of what mycomimicry is what I think is happening.
Right.
These entomopathogenic fungi that parasitize insects prior to sporulation produce these wonderful fragrances that entice the insects to engage them. But we can benefit insects with these fungi as well. So, but the patents have not been licensed. I have the guiding principles in my book, Mycelium Running. Number one guiding principle, we wage no war against nature and against insects. Just don't want insects to eat, termites to eat my house. Number two, this can never be quashed. And number three, I want undilutable control. And this is really important. I've been invited by the scientific group to be an ambassador for scientists. And this is the hard reality. People go, why haven't you commercialized this? Well, did you know that if you get a venture capitalist who gets 20% or more ownership of your company, the banks will not give you a loan or a line of credit unless that venture capitalist co-signs on the line of credit. This is how they take over companies. So the inventor goes, oh, I'll own 51% of what, and they go ahead and they try to commercialize, and every business needs a line of credit. I mean, you know, so the venture capitalists tend to underfinance the inventors, put too much of a burden for them to produce, you know, results. Then they said, you're not producing enough. And the inventors are going, I don't have enough assets, you know, my laboratory, my factory to produce to meet your expectations. Oh, you need more money. Well, your equity now is worth less. They go to the bank, and the bank goes, you need to have your investor who has only 20% co-sign on all your loans. The investor then says, no. What do? You have to negotiate with the investor, and they double down, and you're diluted out of your own invention within just a few years.
So what's the nature? What would the mycelia guide us about business partnerships?
I think beneficial corporations are the way to go.
Uh-huh.
And this liaison...
And that would be the analogy would be they would be like, what? I mean, is there a mushroom they'd...
Well, I don't want to be on record for this because I thought I heard that Google's becoming a beneficial corporation, which means they can go ahead and do philanthropic things without being held hostage by the anger of the stockholders who say, you should have been doing something else that would give me more money.
Or the citizens of San Francisco who are actually quite angry at them for the colonization aspect. But that's a whole different thing.
But in any event, so I think there is a... this idea that inventors need to champion and be the captains of their own business vehicles is really important.
It is.
Otherwise, when the inventors lose their incentives, and like one of my patents, I will say this for the record, I gave it up. And I had a patent in Australia, you know, for all insects. And I said, okay, I'm going to give up this patent. I said this in public to about 800 people. I'm going to give it to the people of Australia. You now have it. Okay, which one of you, without patent protection now, because everybody has it, mm-hmm. is going to risk all your assets, your house, all your life savings to start a business, knowing that any competitor can do the same?
Mm-hmm.
It totally puts into perspective now, oh, patentability for inventors is important for bringing a product to market, because if you don't bring it to market, you can't have societal benefit.
Right.
Ultimately, all patents revert to public domain after 17 years.
Uh-huh.
It rewards the inventor temporarily to incentivize them. So, and then ultimately, patents become open source. So,
right.
And that was four years ago.
Which
not
is kind
a,
of,
not a single person has stepped up to the plate. It suddenly put the burden on them. I said, which one of you is going to champion this at this risk now? And it really mollifies a lot of the critics out there going, ah, yeah, patents. Patent.
No, this is really important. Because people also go, well, yes, I did inhale several of your paragraphs without attribution, and because I can, you know. And in a similar way to going, oh, you want to own your words or you want to have a copyright. And we go, well, yeah, because it maintains the integrity and the kind of DNA, you know, story. You know, you do hard research, or those of us who craft language, it took a long time to come up with that thing. And when we pass it along, we want the kind of DNA connections of its story. Otherwise, you're a GMO Monsanto.
We have written several books. Many of the listeners here have written books.
Yeah.
Can you imagine working on your book and your manuscript for 5 or 10 years, get the whole thing done, take it down to Kinko's or something, someone gets a photocopy of it, and they put their name on it, and they publish it, and they get the money
for
it.
Right. No, Saturn,
it's like, you know,
boundaries are good for us.
Yeah.
Might we think of, well, let's see, let me circle back to Janine Benyus, because she, like yourself, lets me take scientific fact and use it as a metaphor, which is, in fact, myth, and myth was the great conveyance of botanical knowledge down... You know, there's a lot packed into fairy tales and so on. But I do love when I asked her, you know, what is vertical integrated hierarchy, this biological term? She said, it's this wonderful thing. It means everything in nature contains the plan of the larger thing it's a part of. You know, a tendon in our arm is twisted bundled sticks, and each one of those is twisted bundled sticks, and mm-hmm. you know, micro, micro, micro. And so she said this is what makes for nature's resilience, ingenuity, and self-assembling.
Well, I totally agree with that.
So I like to say, you know, for all of us, the likes of ourselves, you know, as we clarify what we're dedicated to, it strengthens our signal, so we're more likely to be danced into place with the whole larger thing that we're part of.
And that's the very foundation of the concept of community.
Yes,
you know, community shares resources.
Yeah.
And we can borrow from each other, and we can trade assets. And right. we have skill sets that are complementary. The skill sets, when they become more and more complementary, it solidifies and makes the integration of society better and stronger. So I think, you know, this is where we need to have this happy compromise of mutualism, you know, throughout our society, ecologically, economically, and socially, is that we should relish the fact that we have diversity. And the more diversity we have, I think the better and stronger, you know, the fabric of our societies will be.
And in all nature and metaphysics, and they are happily being rewedded again, too, we go, there is nothing we don't share. No joy, no sorrow, no ingenuity. We're all in this pulsing dream together, right? I mean, you can go for that.
Yeah, you're right. I love dreams.
Right, exactly. You know, to be a dreamer scientist, to be an animistic science, I mean, these are things that were one thing and have been, you know, falsely sundered by the reality police as a mean trick to keep people ineffective and obedient. But, you know, it's like Peter Warshall, our late great ally, you know, did this great talk on danger and beauty. How throughout time, you know, danger and beauty go together, that fireflies, you know, have this beautiful light, but it also attracts, like you were saying, you know, insects, and then it eats them. And he says, you know, bioluminescence in, you know, octopuses, octopi will develop bioluminescence in the ocean, which is very beautiful, and people go, how beautiful, and then it eats them. And he goes, beauty and danger go together as one of the evolutionary kind of spices of this world, which is why, you know, an art museum just doesn't quite have it, you know, an art opening with people gently sipping bad white wine. But then you know, a number of other people say, you know, what is crisis? And I want to toss this back to the mycelia and yourself as their ambassador. You know, what if crisis is an evolutionary opportunity for our species to become smarter in a big way?
Oh, indeed. Yeah. You know, it's a stimulus-response relationship.
There we go.
If we have a massive nuclear attack, if we have some tremendous viral pandemic, whatever happens, the response of that is a form of epigenesis. It's a selective influence on our genome, and from that genomic library, will have a response. The more diverse that genomic library is, the more abundant and diverse those responses will be. What I fear is that our biological tool chest will be reduced to such a level that we're not going to be able to have the right tools to be able to repair the damage that's being inflicted upon us. We'll go through devolution. 40,000 years ago, we migrated from Africa into Europe. And about 140,000 years ago, approximately, humans declined in the population to about 10,000 individuals that were reproducing. It was a near extinction event, largely due to climate change. And this is something that I think we need to pay attention to. Is as a really good example, the mycorrhizal fungi really help plants to grow. But when you use fertilizers, you defeat the mycelial webs that have evolved specifically to be mutualistic and symbiotic with plants. And fungi mineralize rocks. They actually eat rocks and get minerals, and they give it to plants in the root zone. And right there's a point-specific place where the plant is being given minerals by the fungi. They secrete sugars. And so the mycelium proliferates, is rewarded. But when you add fertilizers, then you defeat the natural systems, and then the plants become addicted to fertilizers, and you diminish the biodiversity of the soil. And this is something that we need. We have a peak phosphorus crisis here in the very near future. In 20 years, the fertilizer industry is going to collapse unless we find new resources for phosphorus. The mycelium and the mushroom mycelium can scavenge phosphorus out of mineralized rock in an effective manner. That's much more effective than mining. But this is mycological mining, and this is what these networks are doing constantly.
And it takes time.
It takes diversity, and so the mycodiversity of our soils is absolutely of paramount importance for our biosecurity.
And again, to have the patience of nature to replace the rapacious greed of short-term vision, as an evolutionary assist, that's really crucial. You speak about the confluence of benefits, the thread of knowledge that, I guess it was the polyphers that we know about 2,500 years of use. I mean, our ancestors know about these things that you're bringing alive again.
Well, yeah, we have a traditional the threat of knowledge. Right. You know, Gujal is a friend of mine. He's the president of the Haida people in the Haida Gwaii.
Yes.
And when I went up there with my stories of Agarikon, and they used Agarikon, they carved Agarikon into little grave guardians that they were putting on the graves of shamans to help them go into the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And the name the Haida use for Agarikon is called ghost bread, the bread of ghosts.
Mm.
And when I came to him... it's white in its form.
Oh, yeah.
And it's called the quinine fungus, even though it doesn't have quinine. But it was it was used since Dioscorides' time over 2,000 years ago as a treatment against consumption, later thought to be tuberculosis. And when I went up to meet him, and then I knew about their history of the Haida, and he said, Paul, people expect us to know all this knowledge about the natural world. But frankly, we've been under assault. We had four pandemics, two flu pandemics and two smallpox pandemics, for which brought over by the Europeans, for which they had no native resistance. And so over 90% of the population was wiped out within 2 or 3 years, four times in a row over 40 years. So he goes, my grandmother used to know a lot about this, but that thread of knowledge has been interrupted. And that's so true throughout the entire world. The body intellect of knowledge that we had, prior to written books, the Library of Alexandria was a huge loss, probably set us back millennia from that burning of that library, several million texts. But before we had the written word or being able to share information via the internet, knowledge was thin, frayed threads going from generation to generation, and many of those threads were broken. And so how much knowledge, have we lost? And so we're trying to regain that, but let's...
And that's the analogy that Claire Cummings brought up when we were talking to molecular biologists about GMOs. She said, might it be, because I know grown-up scientists who go, no, GMOs, we've always done this, what a good idea, and it will save Africa and Bill Gates and Claire pitched to the molecular biologist, is this like cutting our DNA, cutting our guiding story from our ancestors? And they go, exactly the metaphor. Hmm. We're cutting our guiding story by doing GMO, by splicing, putting mackerel genes in this tomato because we're unsupervised.
No, the motivation for GMOs is profit. You're trying to find
out. It's not Save Africa.
Yeah, it's not.
Even though Bill Gates, that's what they pitch.
Well, I've met Bill a few times, and, I'm a little bit shy, to bring out these things up. But the GMO scientists out there, when you look at it, you're going for a target, like Roundup Ready, crops that are resistant to the Roundup, but the weeds around them are not, and they all die off. Well, a GMO sequence codes for more than one protein. So when you look at a gene splicing and the location of those sequences in the genome of the organism, the simple question to ask these GMO scientists is, have you tested every single protein that the gene sequence can code for, or are you just looking for one applicable target in one location for one purpose? And the second is true. Not the first. They haven't tested these.
Right.
And so we're really, there's a superiority complex that scientists oftentimes suffer when they're trying to talk to the people who are less educated than themselves. And it's an example of hubris. And I think the rule that we've learned, especially over the past 20, 30 years, is hubris is the downfall of most.
Well, that's why I like to say, let the hubris of humanism be eclipsed by the humus and truth of animism. Everything's alive. Cooperators are standing by. This is Cooperators Are Standing By Radio. we're going to deconvene in a few minutes. But there's so many things. Do you remember the alpine skeleton? I keep thinking his name was Etsy, but that's not right.
Otzi.
There we go. Etsy is something else, but it's related to Otzi. Otzi. Now, Otzi has been incredibly studied, and been unbelievable. Like, he had his copper ceremonial knife that we can't duplicate with modern technology, and he had a little medicine pouch.
Yeah, and he was a great mycologist.
And he had tattoos over his kidneys. So what was he carrying in his mycological
pouch? He had two polypore mushrooms. These are the hoof fungi that grow on trees.
And what were they good for?
Well, that's a really excellent question. One is called Amadou.
Yes, Amadou.
Amadou revolutionized warfare It is a fire fungus. You can carry fire for days. It delaminates into an incredibly flammable material, and it's been used since ancient times to start fires. And so our ancestors,
because you can carry it from place to place
to rekindle it and grow it up. But amadou, Fomes fomentarius, is a Latin binomial, is the first mushroom ever found to be antiviral against the tobacco mosaic virus. Now, the tobacco mosaic virus and the tobacco ring spot viruses are related, and it's now been found, and this is totally unbelievable, but true, that plant viruses are being carried by mites and given to bees. And so we have a cross-kingdom transfer of a virus that hurts plants to a virus that hurts bees. And amadou, the one that Otzi was carrying, has very potent antiviral properties. So this really is interesting. The other mushroom that he had was another birch polypore called Piptoporus betulinus, and it has very strong antimicrobial properties. And so he had both of those tethered to his right side in a little pouch, and that was important. That was his medicine kit and his survival kit.
Because how old do we think Otzi was?
I think he was about 44 years of age, approximately like that.
And how far back?
5,300 years ago.
5,300 years ago, yeah.
On the border of...
and he was killed by an arrow.
Well, he had an arrow spear in his back, and he died sitting upright, which was interesting, in a snowdrift and froze. The best preserved human going back that far ever discovered.
And we know what he ate, and we know what the thing was.
Right. And the fact that, on my right side, I have my knife, I have my keys, I have my pen.
He was right-handed,
okay. And that's where his most important compounds.
But if we're right-handed, sometimes we carry things on the left, so we don't really...
Not me. If I'm in the woods, going to be attacked by a bear, I want my knife.
I want it there. But anyway. But all right. But we don't.
Well,
okay.
You're different. Everybody knows that.
Right. So blessed Otzi trying to communicate with us. At completely fascinating. So 5,300 years ago, and at age 44, dies sitting up. With tattoos again. Meaningful tattoos, because they're over his kidneys and they're invisible because he's wearing his little cute clothes. But so they are of. Well, we don't know if the tattoos are medicinal, we don't know.
I have no idea.
Anyway, well, blessed Otzi with his mushroom pouch and telling stories for us all now. So yes, well, there's a million things, and we will let us keep talking forever. In some form, not now.
I can do that.
Not now. That would be really great. Anyway, you are a great ally. You are a great ally. Internet, really good. Reciprocal blessing. A fungus could combat chemical weapons. I'm just going through all kinds of things too. Complexity. There we go. No division between us and the environment. There we have it. But I do think that you are in sync. Part of the Neptune dream. Symbolism. Intelligence in nature stationing now its images, girl with a trumpet calling in a new tide of cultural energy. And we go, a cultural climate to address the climate imbalance. So you're part of that, right?
Well, we're on the same team.
We're on the same team.
Even though we may have different colored jerseys.
There we go. Well, bless your heart forever and your great work, Paul Stamets. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.